This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Tech Talk and my name is Jeff Sandhu and I'm here with Karamjit Singh from Digital News Asia, and we're doing today's show slightly different. It's the tiki-taka fever, and just when the news was being read, we were talking about our local clubs, and you asked me what's my local...
Yeah, shame on you,
and
man.
And I said Liverpool.
Look at that, the boy's from Liverpool, is he?
Anyway, so...
So then I had to refine the question and say, what's your hyper-local team?
And then you became Slangola, right? So, the World Cup fever, tiki-taka fever. So yeah, we have 6 billion screens and 4.7 billion devices capable of watching the games.
Exactly.
Is this significant?
Yeah, I think that's why I wanted to lead off with this. Just the sheer numbers, right? It tells you how accessible watching, you know, globally, you know, interesting events, right? I won't say important, like interesting. You know, for a lot of people, football is not important, you know, and how accessible it is now. So with the 6 billion screens may be confusing, but that's your TV set at home too. So that's a screen. Although some TVs are becoming smart, we still have that clear designation. That's a screen. And then when you talk about devices, it's the element of mobile is there. So that's why you've got 6 billion screens, 4.7 billion devices, just to clear that up with the readers out there. Sorry, listeners. Yeah.
So there's so smart TVs is considered as
it's
a screen.
It's a screen. Right. So and the rest are screens also, but they're mobile. So they fall under the device umbrella.
Okay.
But you almost got 5 billion, right? Capable of watching the... is this significant? I don't know, but the number just struck out at me. And as you know, I just did a dipstick survey. I stuck my head out the studio and shouted out at everyone in the BFM room, you know, busy working and updating their Facebook profiles. I saw that too. About how many of them had watched any of the games, you know, over their mobile devices? I use laptop, tablet, and phones. I think 5 hands went up out of the 25 plus people I could see.
Okay.
And my favorite was the person who said, oh, can watch. We won't tell you who that person is. But I guess... it's also maybe because of the time zone difference, right? The games are late at night and you're most likely at home unless you're about to commit a crime or you're out, you know, late parking, you know, at the mamas with your friend. Then you're going to use a mobile device, I guess.
Yeah, I don't use my mobile device to watch the games or stream the games or highlights. Because like you said, you know, the timing of the games, I'm definitely at home.
And this is something where you want to watch on a big screen, right?
Exactly.
The only person who may want to watch it on their mobile device or tablets would be the 22 people who are parents of the players on the field. They don't mind watching on their phone. Oh my God, that's my son, yeah. No, so it sounds sexy to say it's available, but in this kind of context, in a game like this where it's, you know, semi-fast moving, unless you have the Italians playing, you know, so it's not fun watching on the screen unless it's a must-have. You've got no other options. So the number is interesting. And what's interesting, this was from Ovum, right, the UK-based consulting firm, who said that these are alternative TV viewing methods, and they account for almost 60% of all screens. But the important thing is that these devices now give you an alternative viewing experience. But for broadcasters, okay, this is the kicker, and service operators, which means your telcos, you want to provide multi-platform World Cup services, fine, but it should be with minimal technical hiccups, because otherwise the consumer's expectations are that it should be as good as the TV viewing screens. They're going to get upset with you, and then you're going to ruin, you know, your brand reputation with them. So that's not good, lah. And they talk about you can get bad press and, more importantly, frustrated fans. So I thought that was an interesting point just to highlight. But it's not that relevant, I think. It's just one of those interesting things to highlight.
Yeah,
right?
But it leads us nicely to
the segue,
telcos.
We use the word segue.
Telco tales with DG, Maxis and Celco.
So that's the next story. And I think this is part of our deep DNA, inaugural DNA deep dive we did on the telco industry. And while that was a PDF, as you know, Jeff, we are now running each of the stories on our portal also, so that people have easier access to the stories. And today's one was interesting just because it's an industry Q&A with the top 3 players, and we were fortunate enough that they each, you know, use one of their senior people as a spokesperson. So Celcom had Shazali as his spokesperson, Maxis with Morton, and DG gave his CEO Alban. So so what we did was we gave everyone the same question to answer, and you can then look at how each of them views that particular issue, you know, and you can compare them. So I think in that sense, it's very interesting. It's not easy to put this together to get them to hey, you know, share your thoughts. It's the same question being asked to everyone, but we manage it. And I think it's going to be a 3-parter. The first part is out today. You do want to read that because it's quite interesting. Now, some of the points, obviously, and from a data point, that really stands out of you. And not just because Morton told us that 98% of the traffic over his networks is data now. Voice and SMS is only 2%. Crazy, right? For Digi, their traffic growth on data increased 55% year on year. Hmm. And Shazali from Celcom, I was at their Q1 briefing last week. Very interesting to see him in action, you know, extremely personable and persuasive, you know, powerful communicator as a CEO. He said that their year-on-year data traffic grew 16%, okay, from Q1 of 24 versus 2013. And significantly, their smartphone penetration has grown from 24% to 35%. Mm. And Celcom, a lot of their base is still sub-rural and semi-urban, right? Mm. Suburban and rural areas. And Shazali mentioned that too. And this push is mainly led by them, actually. So he said a lot of them now are now moving on to the smartphone platform where then data became the dominant. It's taking over from SMS. And he gave an interesting point of view how Celcom is trying to tackle that issue. And the story was out by Go last week. You want to read that?
All right.
But again, it emphasizes that data is just catching on. And we then asked them this question about... So Morten made an interesting point. He said that as data gets more important, there will be, in his opinion, a bigger difference between the operators in how they deliver this data. And this is going to matter more and more to customers. So maybe at some point, what he's saying is that customers may decide to use a particular service provider because they provide the best data experience.
Yeah.
So this is not rocket science to the three telcos, right, who know everything that's happening and about to happen. They all use the same consultants and it's not rocket science. You know, they're embedded in this ecosystem. They know what's coming up. So that's why they're all now rushing to upgrade their networks or so, especially the data part. Now, this data search, one of the things that's happening with the data search is it puts pressure on two areas of these telcos. One is to upgrade their networks, as I just said, and they also need to sharply improve the network performance. Just like the Oven people saying, if somebody's streaming a World Cup game over your device and if it's choppy or you know it suddenly
it's
lags,
give
or
you
hangs,
a bad experience.
You're not gonna be pissed at FIFA or whatever. You're gonna be pissed at your local telco, you know, and you're not gonna be pissed at the brand name you're using, Lenovo or Samsung or Sony. Yeah. Very interesting. So these guys are all aware of that, and they're moving forward to try to make this happen. Mm. So now Alban then said that one of the pushes for this this demand for data is also the fact that internet services are becoming more affordable, and we know Digi is championing that, right? Making data affordable for all. And he said especially with the penetration of smart devices at the entry level.
Mm.
And this entry level really then is also talking about Celcom's big user group, right? Which Shazali mentioned.
So
it's already happening. And Lundell said that the key to... And okay, Alban also mentioned something that with more high growth digital services coming online, that's going to be another demand driver.
Mm.
And I think 2 weeks ago, we had Dr. Gabriel from Kiosi, and he's talking about how one of the application services is a smart camera, where the camera can identify and warn you of threats that are happening. Mm. So this is one example of services. I know a Malaysian entrepreneur is talking about already delivering this. And as we start using these services, you know, that's going to be pushed the demand for data
more.
So fantastic real example here in the studio itself.
Mm-hmm.
And Lundell said another key is the fact that more and more people are watching video streaming. And he also mentioned that as cloud services, especially for enterprises, gets more popular, it's going to drive the demand for data. And Shazali, when asked the same thing, he said within services, he agrees that it's video and it's enterprise. But he made the other interesting point that they don't see any one vertical as being a key driver for this. That means like entertainment or education or healthcare. None of this stands out as being the key driver why more people are using data. So it's quite uniform across that.
Mm.
So what that's saying to me is that there's no one segment there that is a data adopter more than the other. Because you and I would think that it's consumer and it's entertainment, right? With video, YouTube. It's not at the moment. So that's an interesting insight from that.
Right.
And we also asked, I'm going to just take a breath. You want to go for the break or we can talk about LBS?
We can talk about LBS.
Also because it's related. So, you know, in the early days, everyone was thinking that location-based services is the gold mine for these guys, right?
Yeah.
They know where you are and you want to get messages that are, you know, spot on to what you need maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Or someone's offering a great deal and they say any Celcom customer out there, they're going to get 45% off if they walk into my store in the next 1 hour.
Mm.
So this is really called location-based services. Now, Lundell said something interesting. He said that their location-based advertising, it's the first time I'm hearing this term, is actually being utilized at 90% of its available inventory at most of their commercial locations. Now, he said this feature adds relevance to the messages, right? Where we spoke about that, and that customers elect to receive. Although it's not a big revenue driver yet, he said that they're already offering this service, which means that if you're a retail outlet somewhere, you're a business, and you're a Maxis subscriber, you're using the service, you can tell Maxis that if any of your customers are walking around within the vicinity of my store, you know, you can push them out this message to say they'll get a special deal. Or if you're operating a place that offers massage, maybe it's, you know, 40% off.
Mm.
So interesting that it says 90% of the inventory for this is being used up. Very interesting. Now, Shazali said that the bulk of their value from location base will come from integrating with other capabilities. Very interesting. He didn't use it as a standalone. So for Cellcom, location base is one component of a wider ecosystem where he talks about loyalty management, campaign management, big data and more. So big words, but I think they're seeing it in a more holistic sense.
Yeah.
And he says that they recognize, and he used the word ecosystem. He said, we recognize that the biggest undertaking of any new deployment, which is LBS, will depend on the ecosystem around it.
All right.
So very interesting. That always thinks great things, exciting things going on in the telco space, right?
Always. Yeah. Always. Anyways, we will take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about Badli Sham's last press conference as the MDEX CEO. And more. This is Tech Talk on BFM 89.9.
Break from monotony. BFM 89.9.
And we are back on. I'm here with Karamjit Singh from Digital News Asia. And let's move on straight because we are running out of time, apparently. So, Badli Sham's last press conference as the MDEX CEO. What's the occasion?
I think it was the announcement of how the MSC Malaysia companies did last year. So, it was the 2013 announcement. It is a bit late compared to last year. But he said there were some things that came up and the board needed to obviously, you know, give the green light to. So, it was delayed by 1 month. But timing was good because then with him tomorrow being his last day at MDEC after 8.5 years, actually. I thought he joined MDEC in 2008. He actually joined them in 2006. I think it was January or February. So it's almost, you know, 8.5 years. And it was...
How are they doing?
I think they're doing okay. I think they're doing good in terms of how the revenue of their combined companies has gone up. And if you see the article, there's a nice infographic MDEC gave, you know, where it says that they've earned, their combined companies earned 34.55 billion ringgit last year. And it was a growth of 3% from 2012. Now, when you have a growth of 3% now, of course, at some point, somebody in a press conference is going to ask, you know, doesn't that show that the industry is slowing down? That growth is only 3%? Because you think technology fast moving, and also adoption is getting more and more, right? We just talked about data, and that's under the ambit of technology too. But Sham was asked, is this a sign of slowing down? And I think he was ready for that because he said absolutely not. And he mentioned the fact that because to MDEC, this is quality growth. And he brought the point up that he mentioned last year, so it was consistent in the fact that he said that Malaysia had 27 million people. I think we're touching 30 million now. So I'll correct him. So the fact that we've got 30 million people, the population base is still relatively small. You cannot play the scale game when you want to go into a technology space. And so he talked about MDEC having already been concentrating on quality growth. And he gave the example that if he said if they just wanted to go for top line numbers, they could bring in a lot of attract a lot of investments in where people just hire a lot of people and and medium and low level jobs. And he said he made a good point. These jobs are not sustainable and they won't remain long in a country where if the cost base suddenly changes, you know, they're gone, right? You want to bring in a quality investment and jobs because those will stay. And that's why he said they're actually quite happy with the result. If you look in that context, he said. They are quite happy with the performance, you know, revenue-wise.
And they've created new jobs as well, right?
They've created new jobs. So it's interesting that the number of new jobs they created was 9,200, and they didn't highlight this in their in the thing versus last year. Last year, their companies, right? There were 500 more jobs created last year than this year. So they didn't want to highlight that because then this was a drop of about 6%, right? Small, but I think the more important figure here and which supports what Badli Sham says about high quality jobs is the fact that, if I can get the page right, is that these new jobs last year created an average rise in salaries of 5%. So the average salaries was $5,746, you know, which is decent by any accounts, right?
Yeah.
So that shows that their strategy is kind of in the right place. And then you can go and read the article a bit more. There's a lot more data there. But these were the highlights for me. You know, revenue is still growing. They're selective in their approach. And I think it's a smart strategy. And you look at the average income of those new jobs. Anyone would want that, right?
All right. AIM, Agency Inovasi Malaysia, to be dissolved.
Yeah. Oh,
why?
Not so dramatic. I have to admit that this is one of the cheeky things you do when you're on the online space. You come up with a headline that's kind of sexy and intriguing, right? So, and this has always been AIM's charter anyway, that it would be dissolving in 2020 because AIM was set up in 2010 and they were already running since then. and sorry, 2008. So it takes time to get these initiatives up. And I think for Mark, one of the interesting things is that when you talk to him and you ask him, right, tell us how you're doing, he will actually ask you, how much time do you have? Just because they've got 18 initiatives under the umbrella, and that's just in recognition that no one initiative or two or three or four or five can be the magic button where you suddenly see a country or a company becoming more innovative, right? So they've got two. One is developing the ecosystem, which is longer term, and another one is part of the ecosystem that maybe you can get a bit of quicker wins. So they've got 18 initiatives, but of course I didn't spend time talking about those 18 initiatives because we've mentioned some of them before. And I think you would have had this guy in called Bass Milson or something. He's with AIM, and he runs their wealth creation initiative, and that's where their national biomass strategy sits. And because that's a $9.3 billion initiative, with, you know, potential GNI, a lot of the tension goes there, and it's gaining good traction too. But I wanted to look at some of the other sectors, so I asked him what he was excited about. Now they've got this conference coming up at the end of in August, which is called the Innovating Malaysia Conference. Now in that conference, they're going to introduce something called this index, which is the National Corporate Innovation Index. So for him, simply the idea of this index is to get our Malaysian corporates, private sector, to start thinking a little bit about it and to make them realize that innovation does have a payback. It may be longer term and it's supposed to be, but it's absolutely worth your time and investment and resources to focus on that, to question how can our company be more innovative? What can we do differently or better so that we're more sustainable and more competitive 2 years down the road? And that's the high level picture. You can read the article because that's lots of good stuff there. So this is one of the recent things they're trying to do to change the mindset in the corporate world, because he acknowledges that CEOs have a short-term mindset, you know, and vision, because, but then, you know, innovation is long-term, medium-term, right? So this is interesting. And during this conference, they're going to highlight also some of the success companies which have successfully moved along the path of innovation. And the rationale is nothing moves the CEO to act more than when a competitor in the same industry is doing something interesting and they're showing results, right?
And quicker and, as well.
Yeah, exactly. And you're not going to say, hey, we can't do that. Like, they're just smarter than us. Nobody's going to say that, right? Say, hey, why are they getting it right? Let's do it too. So very interesting approach.
All right. Reading list for this week. Before reading we end list? The show, we've got 2 minutes.
Okay. I think reading list is the Job Street. Right? So surprisingly for us, Jeff, the two stories that we run that get a lot of traction are those which revolve around the education sector, which is our universities. We did something on universities R&D last week. Very well read. And also when you talk about jobs, you know, when Job Street have any of their surveys out, it really gets a lot of traction. And this one was on a survey they came up with, Malaysia, Singapore, very interesting, about more white-collar Malaysians open to working abroad. And actually, the survey showed that 80% of Singaporeans, white-collar workers, would be open to working abroad. Malaysians are actually around the 60% range, so it's higher in Singapore. As high as salaries are there, interesting, there's so many white-collar workers, you know, that would jump at the chance to work overseas. And of course, I'd like to remind them that Malaysia is technically overseas. So you're all free to welcome and come and contribute to our economy, right?
The other reading list.
The other reading list, yes, is Gabby wrote an interesting piece on how early market validation is a must for startups. So that very interesting article. She pulled together a few thoughts, you know, and came up with that piece. We internally all enjoyed reading it, and it's absolutely worth your time to read it and get, you know, a primer of what's going on in that space.
And it's exclusive Digital News Asia content as well.
I'm glad you brought it. No, this is an article she contributes once a week to the Star also, their Metro section, because she obviously joined us from the Star, and they like the insight she gets from what she does running around doing DNA stuff. So this was written for them, but they have been extremely supportive and allowing her to use it on DNA too.
All right. So I've been speaking to Karamjit Singh from Digital News Asia, and I think you can check out all the articles all the stories that we've talked about is on your website.
Yeah, on the portal.
DigitalNewsAsia.com. This is Tech Talk on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.